round, round, get around.
I get around.
Yeah,
get around, round, round. I get around.
I get around.
I'm not a fan of how this is happening, but the chance to do PME with retired 37th Commandant of the Marine Corps. Do I have that number right?
Yes, sir, you do.
Bob Neller is.
So you remember you were just playing the beach. I remember when I heard Good Vibrations on my AM radio when I was in, I want to say junior high, and was like, this is like, what a cool song.
What kind of car did the Nellers roll around in?
Oh, with Lansing was Oldsmobile, so we always had Oldsmobiles.
Oh, really? We were a punk.
Had Oldsmobiles. My dad, Chevy truck. He had a Pontiac station wagon for a while, but my mom's car was always a Olds 98.
Yeah, we were a Pontiac family. And the coolest thing about Pontiacs was when you turn the brights on, the high beams, there was a silhouette of Chief Pontiac. Or at least that's what they said. And so it was like,
yeah, Pontiac, I mean, that was, all the muscle cars and all that back in the 60s, that was, I remember when gas went to 35 cents a gallon, I couldn't believe it. How could this possibly happen?
People don't, I tell my kids those stories, they're like, come on, that was never. I'm like, oh no, it was cheap.
So where was the cheapest gas that you, when you were growing up, when you were cruising in high school?
Terrible Herbst.
Is that right?
Terrible.
We would go to the Zephyr or the Clark station. Plus, if you bought cigarettes, they didn't ask for ID. I wouldn't do anything like that, but some of the people I hung out with were,
and it was a kind of a novel thing when you went to a gas station. Stations started putting in self-serve islands.
Yeah, that was
right, because when you went there, that was somebody's station, and he came out, and he normally had a rag in his back pocket. He's wearing some kind of blue coveralls or a uniform with his little kind of oval thing on his chest with his name. Came out and did your. Checked your oil, did your windows.
Yeah. And then everybody, you take up a collection and you get $2 and you give me $2 worth of regular and you were good for the night.
There you go.
We digress.
Well, I mean, there's serious stuff going on in the nation. So first of all, I appreciate you doing that. I mean, the feedback was overwhelmingly positive about, one, your choice to write about issues, and two, but hearing people that have gone through this stuff, more than once in a lifetime, that have developed the wisdom of experience, looking at this through a little bit longer lens, and saying and talking about things that need to happen in the country. So just from a lot of different people who enjoyed your column, your letter to America. Thanks for doing that, and thanks for coming back. And today we'll talk about another thing you wrote, which is managing our police force, a different way to do it. I probably know the answer to this, but what inspires you to write again?
I've been watching, like everybody else, you watch all the things that have been going on with police. And again, you have to keep it in context. This is complicated and you're not there. Kind of the rule was, you remember this, when you were in the fight, people would say, well, so-and-so did this or so-and-so did that. And you were like, were you there? Because if you weren't there, you'd seen it and you didn't see it with your own eyes, then maybe you should just sit down and wait for others to tell you exactly what happened. Don't draw conclusions. But some of the stuff I think we've seen because of body cameras and other things, and none of them are, cut and dry. Like the one in Atlanta the night before last, the guy with the Wendy's, you watch that, but you don't see the whole thing. Right. And you can't tell the whole thing, but the end result is this guy's apparently been drinking, apparently asleep in the drive-through line, and the police stop him and they're going to detain him for, you know, I watched this. Can you just take me home? I mean, back in the day, they probably, I don't know, why didn't they just take him home? Or just, hey, give me your keys. But they, you know, they're going to, so the guy's legally intoxicated and they're going to arrest him. And then, and for whatever reason, the thing went bad and he grabs the taser and then shoots at one of the officers and then runs away and they chase him and he turns around and then it appears that, I'm not going to presume I know what happened, but the guy's dead. He got shot. One of the officers appears to have shot the guy. I mean, and so this all started with a guy asleep in his car at the drive-thru because he had too much to drink.
No, and you,
I mean, we've just been watching this stuff, and at some point you just like, you know, there, and I have, I mean, and you know, we're not there. We're not tired. We're not out at night. We're not able to see the whole thing. We don't know what everybody said. But, you know, when somebody gets killed for a misdemeanor or something, you just got to ask yourself, okay, how were these guys trained? What were they thinking? How did this thing escalate into the use of what you and I would call as Marines deadly force? And so I've been thinking about it and I've been watching it and trying it. And I've gotten involved here in the area I live in with some training, particularly response to active shooters. I've met a lot of law enforcement people and, you know, they're out there and you talk to them about their training or in many cases their lack of training. Because the police are day on, stay on, and you and I have talked about this. You know, when do they train? When do you reset? When do you pull people off? When do you, you know, in the state of Texas, you're required to requalify with your weapon one time a year. Once, and even though you're on the street every day, I don't consider that sufficient. You know, when do you go through different training on your authorized use of force? Other than at the academy, every academy is different. I met a guy I met at a training facility who's a retired Austin cop and was a SWAT guy, undercover guy. He's the brother of a senior retired Marine friend of mine. And we're just talking and he's frustrated and, you know, everybody's got their view. So all I was trying to do was say, look, this is complicated. It's a tough problem. It's just like dealing with the racial views and the attitudes of the culture of all groups in this country. There, you know, it's not something that's going to be fixed overnight. And same thing with police. I mean, you know, you got police at different training, they have different areas. Like you and I talked about, I mean, the great majority of police are in police departments of 25 people or less. How are they going to train? Where do they train? They don't even have an academy. They're probably guys that went to another city and got trained there and then came back. So there's work to do. I'm watching all the stuff that's being done in the Capitol, in the states. But at some point, there's going to have to be some sort of national standard for police training and authorized use of force. And at the same time, though, I mean, like we talked about, everybody, you know, we wouldn't have to have this if people were abiding the law and were compliant with the police when they make a legitimate request. But at the same time, I don't think you should have to die for some of these things that you're doing, which are technically violations of the law. So, again, like the letter of America, I was like, hey, listen, we need to talk about this. But the thing that I'm concerned about, I mean, I'm concerned about a lot of things, but the one thing you and I've talked about is, you know, how, you know, police out there for, you know, day on, stay on for 5, 10, 15 years. And at some point you got to be held accountable, but there's got to be some understanding that people are not going to be as effective as they might be. This guy that is charged with the death of killing George Floyd, what do you have, like 15, 16 allegations? He'd been on the street for 19 years.
Yeah, I want to say he had 18. I remember Mike Musselman and I talked about this after the Philando Castile event. and that is the cop. He's trying to tell the cop that he's got a pistol and he's got a concealed carry, and you can hear the cop screaming, clearly losing his shit. And then he shoots him four times. And so, you know, we had this discussion about, you know, regional training centers, because not everybody, and I want to get to this, not everybody can afford it. And then and then you have to have personnel. If it's our training day, who's out there on the street doing it? Somebody that's going to cost money. And so for every community around the country, there's a, you know, there's a tax increase. Is there a way to share that nationally? Is there a, you know, much the way we build, you know, highways and streets and stuff, is there a federal, local, and state share for all of that that we can do to implement some of it? Because, you know, when you think of Eric Garner selling cigarettes, you think of, you know, Mr. Floyd, you know, he's passing maybe a $20 counterfeit bill, or somebody that he was with was doing that. And then the guy Brooks in Atlanta, he falls asleep, intoxicated or whatever, and they're all dead. I mean, so by anybody's version of law and order, that's the juice is not relative or related to the squeeze. I mean, it's just, how does that happen? And we continue to see it. And you see, you know, today, you know, I saw black police chiefs from around the country saying, hey, as awful as it is, that officer's justified in doing what he did. And you cringe and you think, okay, so where do we find the kind of police officer that are so sure of themselves, so confident of their abilities, that they can attempt to detain somebody, get into a grappling match with them, somebody get a pistol taken away, a taser, now we're pursuing him. I get shot with the taser, and instead of using deadly force, I holster my weapon and I say, "We've got his car. We'll deal with him later."
Yep, let him go.
I'm
involved with there's a federally funded, it's a FBI curriculum, Department of Justice, called Advanced Law Enforcement Emergency Response Training, and it deals with active shooters, response to an active shooter event. And so an organization that I work with, you know, they're part of the training, and they use either retired cops as kind of adjunct faculty. But, you know, I've been to the training, I've watched the training, and the majority of the officers that are there are still serving officers. They've taken a day off. They've taken a leave, like a week out of their own time, to take paid leave to go to this training to get the certification. Some of them are there in uniform because they're on the clock. Because their department, you know, they let them go. But if something were to happen, they would call them. You know, they got their radios, they got all their gear on, and they're like, call them, and they have to get in their cars, and they would have to leave. So how do you do this? How do you have enough depth? I mean, and I talk about this in the article or the paper about police reform. You know, in the military, we train, we get worked up, we go through an exercise, we get certified, we deploy. We do our mission for however long it is, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, maybe 12, in some cases early on in the war. You know, the Army had units doing 15 months. And then you come back and you get a short break, and then you reset and you're getting ready to go again. But police, they don't get that period. They don't get the training set. They don't get reset. I know they get shuffled, they get moved to traffic, or they get put to homicide, or they get to put – they may be an admin job, maybe they go to the academy, but you know, there's no national standard. At least I've been led to believe that. So there's a lot of work to do, but I think it starts with training, and I think there's got to be some way to, you know, take a look at this. I mean, how long am I going to leave you out there? How long is, you know, you want to have enough time to get experience, get comfortable, know the area. Do you move people around to different areas, and you got to relearn all the, you know, the dynamics of the area and who's who and who the owners are and who the players are and, you know, what happens at this store and what happens on this street. or do you leave them in the same place? And people say, well, you need more people from their hometown. I don't know. I mean, the old, you know, the local cop on the beat in New York and Boston back in the day. I don't know. Maybe that worked. Maybe it was a lesser of another bad situation. So it's complicated. Like we talked about, there, now this stuff is easy. We would have figured it out already.
I want to kind of pick some stuff out of the article that you put up on LinkedIn, and gets forwarded all over the place. It's entitled "Managing Our Police Force: A Different Way to Do It," and then the first part entitled, subtitled "Police Reform." You talk about size of the police force is a relevant issue relative to this. Could you expand on that?
Well, a lot of the discussion, you know, defund the police. So we're going to cut the resourcing of police. So, okay, does that mean we have fewer police officers, or do we do our, I think it's a fair discussion, and I think it's a smart discussion at policing. You know, do we need to have uniform officers doing traffic? I mean, there are a lot of cameras out there. I don't see it changing the behavior. Maybe we're not given enough tickets. I mean, they're, you know, specifically, you want to raise money for the police, just, you know, figure out how to use a surveillance system, not visual ID, but for facial identification. But, you know, you can ID stuff. I mean, you go on the toll road and you either got a easy pass, or down here it's a Texas tag or whatever it is in your state, and they take your picture and they scan it and you get to drive. And if you don't, they take a picture and they send you a bill. If you don't stop, you know, signal, you go too fast, you know, we can do that with more and more of that with automation, and that's going to come, and that allow the police to go do other things like, you know, law and order or policing. But I think the number is important. I mean, here in the city of Austin, there's a big discussion because of money. You know, they, whether or not they were going to have a new class at the police academy. The city's growing, one of the fastest growing cities in the nation. And, you know, the police are working to keep, you know, keep things going, keep on top of all the calls they get. I mean, the police don't call and people are calling for the police. And if you've got a smaller number of police, which would be the result of reduced funding in some cases, or that funding is going to have to go for something else, who's going to answer all those calls? I mean, if you listen to the Atlanta case that we were talking about, it was somebody at Wendy's, the manager or somebody at Wendy's, who called about the sadly deceased gentleman that was passed out or asleep in the drive-thru.
Mr. Brooks.
Yeah. So it was the manager at the Wendy's that called about Mr. Brooks. Because, hey, the guy's blocked. He's keeping me from doing my business. And so they come and he pulls over and it appears thing was, you know, going to be working itself out, but then it, for whatever reason, it went bad. So, I mean, those things happen, sadly, and we can't be naive about it. I mean, this is just, you know, basic human behavior, let alone, you know, severe criminality, you know, break-ins, robberies, homicides. I mean, all the stuff that the police do. So it's great.
It's great
to say we want to do it in another way.
Okay. Right.
I think that's fair. How do you want to do it, and how are you going to pay for it?
I can hear Will Costantini yelling at me. What problem are you solving?
Will Costantini yells at everybody. I love you. If you will, if you're out there, I miss you, man. Take care of yourself.
What problem are you solving? And so, in my opinion, right, as you classify police shootings, right? The shootings of Mr. Brooks, he's armed. And I've gone through the last few years of the database that the Washington Post keeps. And, you know, the majority of the unarmed events follow a very, very similar pattern. And I will exclude all of them. And in some years, it's almost 50%. Of those events, which are somebody trying to use a vehicle to run over a cop, I mean, they're technically unarmed as long as you don't count the car as a deadly weapon, which it is. But everything else follows this pattern, and that is somebody's going to be apprehended. They resist arrest. That apprehension goes wrong. And somehow or other, the person being arrested either gets a taser, gets a flashlight, and begins beating, you know, the officer, who then says, "I was in fear for my life," and then defends himself. And so, some of those people ultimately get categorized as armed. So the problem we're trying to solve is not only the people that are unarmed, but some people that are categorized as armed ultimately, and whose lives are taken. But it starts as the guy's selling cigarettes on the sidewalk, for God's sakes. The guy's passing a $20 bill. The guy's asleep in Wendy's, and now they're dead. And so, to me, that's the problem that we're trying to solve, which is a disproportionate response to, you know.
I think it goes back to training. I'm not cognizant, or I'm not conversant or knowledgeable about the law, but there's some law that I think need to be reviewed as to at what point does the thing escalate into the use of what you and I would call deadly force. And so Mr. Brooks, you know, he got home, he turned and pointed the taser at the cop, and every police officer has an inherent right of self-defense if he feels his life is threatened. But his life, I don't know, easy for me to say his life was or wasn't threatened by the taser. Easy for me to say, why don't you just let him go? I mean, how far is he going to go? You got his car. Or at the beginning, when the guy said, can you just give me a ride home? Why don't you just take him home? Lock his car up. Call him a cab. Police should have ability to call an Uber and say, take this guy home. If the Uber will pick him up, if the guy's, you know, behavior. Or just put him in the back, say, okay, I'll take you home. Or your wife. I mean, call your wife. You know, call a friend. I don't know. There's, you know, we train Marines, we train soldiers, you know, the different tenets of the rules of engagement: hostile act, hostile intent, minimal force to counter the threat, collateral damage, and proportionality. It starts with every person has the inherent right of self-defense. So when you start talking about hostile act, hostile intent, okay, minimal force to counter the threat, you know, collateral damage to anybody who happens to be, if you are going to execute the use of force, and minimum force to counter the threat. So the question in all these is, okay, did at some point, did when you get to, okay, like in the case of George Floyd, so he's handcuffed, he's down, seems to have the guy subdued, maybe he's resisting. I don't know, I haven't seen the whole thing, but you would think that, you know, when somebody says to you, I mean, you think about the rules we have for handling when we would handle detainees, you know, the five S's, right? Secure, search, safeguard, segregate, and speed. Safeguard. Safeguard. So I secure them. I safeguard them. I take away them, make sure that they're not a threat to me. So I don't know. I don't know enough about the police training, but I think the idea of how many police we have, how often do they train, what is the training they get, what is the ladder that we use that takes you up the escalation of force? I mean, it can go very rapidly. I mean, if the guy had a handgun or not a taser, it'd be something he turned around, like, we wouldn't be having this discussion, I don't think. Because, you know, I got hostile act, hostile intent. But again, you know, it's easy for us to sit here in the quiet of our own home in a nice air conditioned space, you know, had our dinner and we're going to sleep in a nice clean bed, and you're not having to deal with whatever tensions or pressures any party in any of these engagements or any of these actions has.
Talk to me about, in your piece, you write, So I do support resetting and reformatting our police forces, but I would do so in the following manner. And you make 3 points. Talk about those points.
I think there's a place for automation. I think there's a place for training. I think there's a place for where police, how many there are and what you do with them. At this discussion, and I'm watching what's going on in D.C. and other places, but how long is somebody out there? So use of force, escalation of force, use of automation, use of technology. I think police forces have tried to have the demographics of the force better represent their community.
Right.
And, some have done it better than others. It's interesting to me that, the chief of police in Minneapolis is a black man or a man of color. Chief of police that just resigned in Atlanta, I think, was a woman. And that's fine. I mean, but they also, I don't know if they grew up in that town or they were hired in because they were successful in other places. I'm not, it's like being inside. Once you're inside, it's difficult. When you were sitting around as Marines and people are complaining about the Marine Corps isn't good at this. And, it's very easy to get defensive. And it's difficult to take the criticism. I had a friend of mine, retired Marine, senior Marine officer, who the chief of police in the city he grew up in, the job was open, and he applied for it. But he had no police experience, and so but he made it to like the last cut. And they called me, so he used me as a reference. And the guy called me up, and he says, "Hey, I'm calling you about the." Consideration of Joe Benatz to be our chief of police. I said, you should hire him. And here's why you should hire him. The guy's a perfect, he's a great trainer. He understands requirements. He cares about the city or wouldn't apply for the job. He's not doing it. He doesn't need to do the job. He's doing it because he's concerned about what's going on in that city, but you're not going to hire him. And I wasn't trying to be cynical or be a jerk about it, but I said, you're not going to hire him because you're not going to take the risk of bringing in somebody who's completely, totally from the outside, who's going to hold a mirror up and say, ask you hard questions about why you do what you do. And until that happens, and that's uncomfortable. I mean, it's difficult to be self-critical and self-analytical of an organization that you grew up in. It's just difficult.
But in your piece, you make the assertion that if we're closer demographically to the community, we have a better chance of being.
I think so. But
self-critical.
There's also been, maybe you grew up in that neighborhood, or maybe you know the area, or I don't know. Or maybe you're perceived differently by the population. I'm not saying that law and order is like an counterinsurgency, but, I don't think police, when you're talking to somebody, we would always tell the Marines, say, if you're going to talk to somebody, take your glasses off because they want to see your eyes.
Right.
And you want to see their eyes. It appears that you're disinterested or you're trying to intimidate. But I think the demographics important. I think having more women on the police force is important because women have different person, and I'm not being sexist here, but I think it's a documented fact that women are handle situations differently than men, maybe more effective in communication skills and able to diffuse things in a different way. Technology, but how we train,
right?
And then this, how long are you there?
So I wanted to talk
about how long could you be there? I mean, if you were, a lot of the law enforcement folks were prior military people,
right?
And, you know, they got out until the recent change in the retirement, and they didn't have any, they didn't bring anything with them. You know, so now you come in the military in 4 years from now, when everybody is, you know, has, if you decided to do the 401k thing, you can bring that with you. And now you can bring that with you, and you don't, you can use that, your retirement thing, and take it to the police. I would think that the police, if somebody got out of the military before they were retirement eligible, that they would do something if they want these very, I think, very quality, smart, well-trained, disciplined folks, drug-free, to become police officers. They would do something about, you know, hey, I'll pay up front for your retirement. I don't know. There's got to be a way to get you know, people in to do this, and I think there's got to be a way to get them out. You can't, I mean, I don't know what mandatory retirement is, but to do this, you know, to be on the street for 10, 15, 20 years, I just don't see how that, I mean, some people can do it, you know, and they're good at it, but others, I think the average person is, that's too much to ask.
I agree with you. The, you also talked about, I'll link two things you talk about. You talk about empathy, which I will link to a better understanding of what constitutes a hostile act. And the link I'll create between them is there's, in my opinion, an empathy that comes from confidence and your ability to be restrained. That's an important, because a lot of times this stuff spins so quickly. And, you know, the one, you know, here in Atlanta, you know, is a perfect indication of that, right? And that is, right, is there enough empathy there? Two, he's fleeing. He got one of our tasers. Should we kill him? And so to me, there's an empathy there, and that gets linked to hostile act. And then I would link that to what you talk about in your article when you talk about hostile act, which is training. And then also the cost of that training to a community. It's not, as somebody who got elected to a city council, you know, when you live in a town of less than 100,000 people and you're talking about adding, you know, a half a dozen police officers because you got to cover training shifts so guys can go train. That's not an insignificant cost. That means people's taxes are going up to pay for it. So comment on that, because, you know, if the goal is to bring the number down of both people categorized as unarmed, as well as some of the people that will ultimately be categorized as armed, if that's the goal, to bring that down, the level of police violence down, you know, especially for misdemeanor and what I think I would call menial offenses, there's got to be this link, you know, between a person who's empathetic, who's got the restraint born of confidence and training that a city can pay for. You want to expand on that? Because I think it's not easy for communities.
No, I don't know if we can. It's just like, you know, if you can afford the police force that you want, because you can't afford, it's like teachers, we can't afford to pay teachers what they're worth. I think this whole COVID thing is making us realize that people in this country do all sorts of jobs and tasks and things that are absolutely critical to make this place work. And, you know, we probably don't understand that some of them are working, you know, that job and another job, and their spouse is working, and to try to keep, you know, their family, keep their kids, you know, living in the lifestyle they'd become accustomed to. And now when, you know, one or two of them lose their job, or they lose one of their jobs, you know, things are really tough. The empathy thing, you know, when you say empathy, you know, most people, they think, oh, you're talking about being soft and not being, no, I mean, empathy has nothing to do with not maintaining the standard or enforcing the law. When I was in on active duty, I was talking to the guys at MARSOC about how they, you know, what was the profile for those people that were successful in making it through the MARSOC qualification course. And you would ask this to Quay, what qualities do you think? You ask the audience, you know, rhetorically, they're physically fit, of course. They're smart. Yeah, they're smart. They have to have a certain mental ability. But quite frankly, it's actually, they have to be smart, but they don't need to be Mensa smart. I mean, you just got to be able to figure stuff out. So when I would ask them, and these are guys you know, Jim Glenn and Brett Bourne and Pete Hundley and, you know, Matt Trollinger and real, you know, very capable Frank Donovan, tough guys.
Right.
You're like, what was like the one thing that, you know, broke them out, broke the people that did really, really well out from others that made it but or didn't make it? And they go, oh, it's easy. Empathy. You're like, empathy. Says, yeah. The ability to relate to the other person on the team, the other person who's having a hard time, understanding the culture that they were dealing with, because you're maybe training foreign militaries, you're in a different place that you're not used to, or you're not comfortable, maybe you don't speak the language, or there's, you know, things you don't understand. And you have to be able to kind of mentally put yourself in that place. It doesn't mean you're not alert. It doesn't mean you're not in the David Grossman, you know, red, green, yellow, green type of thing. You're always in the yellow. You're always alert, but you're not in the high yellow or red where you exhaust yourself. You're focused. So you have to be able to train. You have to talk about it. And some people are innately better at it than others. And I think most police, I mean, they wouldn't want to do what they do and go out and do what they do every day if they didn't get some level of satisfaction that they're helping the community. And they can get, there's other jobs that are probably, the policing doesn't pay that well. And maybe they're looking for the retirement. And I mentioned a retired Marine I met that's on the Austin PD, and I asked him what he gets paid. He's a basic patrolman. He retired as a senior. He's retired as a first sergeant. And he makes like, I don't know, 50, 60 grand. It's not a lot of money to be out there every day, potentially putting your life on the line. So you can test for this. You can evaluate it. You can look for it. There's psychological profiling, diagnostic tools. And I'm sure a lot of that stuff is used. But at the same point, if somebody tests really low for certain things, are you going to disqualify them? Or are you going to take the risk and let them go out there? Or are you going to watch what they do in training? Or are you going to reset them? Or if they have a series of complaints, what do you do? You know, whether it's substantiated or not, it's like anything else. You know, somebody tells me something once, okay. Somebody tells me the same thing or similar thing a second time, all right, I'm listening. It happens a third, fourth time, I'm really paying attention now. So the police have got to be accountable, but the citizenry, we have to be accountable too. And it's just like, it's easy to be a great leader if everybody's a great follower. But not everybody's a great leader, and not every organization is full of great followers.
You didn't address this in your article, and so we'll close this part of our discussion with this question. How again, and I go back to your experience relative to white hot issues like Marines United. How would you, if you were the mayor of XYZ City, and you knew you had to take a look at these things, you knew that you see the air is so, you know, electrical, so highly charged, but we've got to come together and we've got to consider these issues, and we got to find a way to get to a better place relative to our community and policing. How would you do that? In terms of, you know, bringing people together, making sure they feel comfortable, advice that you would give to people on how to do that? Because that's going to be an interesting discussion when different people when different people vent their spleen, and which is what you're going to invite. When the police union vents its spleen and pushes back and starts throwing out data, you know, the Black Lives Matter representatives is going to go through the roof. And we've got to get through that to go get to a better place. Is there an art to?
I don't know. I mean, I think you have to get what I would advise if I were a mayor or a governor or whatever. Let's get a group of people that are experts in certain areas, psychological evaluation, technology, and the ability to use technology to improve, you know, certain things that may or may not require a human being. Let's get some people that are professional trainers. Let's get some people that are, you know, maybe represent the clergy or the faith groups. And let's get the people from the politicians. You know, one thing I'd also suggest to a mayor, I'd ask a mayor, I'd say, mayor, when was the last time you and a city council went out and rode around with the police? When was the last time you did a ride along? I mean, you're up here, understandably, frustrated and angry and, you know, not happy with the way things are going. Okay, so show some empathy. Let's go ride around the cops. Let's go ride around. And try to understand, you know, what their a day in their life is. And maybe, you know, give you some different context. Because everybody's going to, you know, have their own view. But until you can kind of broaden your view and look at things from everybody else's point of view. I mean, I'm a white man. I will never understand what it's like to be a black man. I can try. I can read every book. I can listen to everybody. But it's just not going to happen. Or for my children, what I have to tell my kids. But those are, so you have to figure that out. But that's kind of what I would do. But I do think those things, you know, who we pick, how we pick them, how long they stay out there, what they do, what is their core task. I mean, you and I would call it a mission analysis. Okay, what do they have police for? I mean, you know, to support, you know, to protect and serve, to enforce the laws. Okay, what laws do we enforce? Do the police need to enforce? You know, you don't want police getting involved in domestic abuse. Okay, what if the, you know, one of the participants is intoxicated or under the influence and has got a weapon and is threatening the other partner? So you're going to send a social worker in there? I mean, so people have got to be, they kind of get off their high horse a little bit and start thinking about, okay, the police have a tough job. And again, they're still accountable. We're all accountable.
And some of the jobs that they've been given, like mental health, nobody else would do it.
No, that's right. So the defund the police and, you know, we're going to do community security. Okay. And for some things that might work. I'm not saying it won't work. I'm not, but at the same time, until the day comes when, you know, we pound our swords into plowshares and there are no bad people anymore, and there's going to be a requirement for somebody to maintain law and order and maintain, you know, protect the innocent.
And I would say that in order to achieve this vision of this kind of policing, it's not going to be cheaper, right?
No, it's going to be more expensive. It'll just be, you're going to have to come up with.
Yeah.
And so then when everybody say you want to pay for this, how are you going to pay for it?
Yeah. I mean,
hear anybody talk, you know, we're already running. Because of COVID and the effect on the economy, what, $2 trillion deficit this year and rising?
Right.
Now they're talking about another, payment, family payment for, okay, I understand extreme times call for extreme action, but you don't hear anybody talking about, you know, raising the gas tax because gas is cheap right now or doing anything to help pay for this
I remember, you know, a program, I believe President Clinton started it. And when I was on the city council, you know, we were under a lot of pressure to hire additional cops using this program. The problem was the Clinton program, if I'm not mistaken, paid for the first 3 years of the cops' time on your force. And then after that, you built structure around these, let's say, half a dozen police officers. And then every one of them is going to cost you $150,000 between their wages, their pension, and their medical coverage and their insurance and all of the rest of that. So you're talking about close to $1 million to hire three police officers for a small city. And so there's these programs out there, but until you saw the financial part, a city will look at that and the city will push back on it, at least the people that can do math will, and say, look, let me take you down the road because I've been down this road before. We're going to get a grant, right, that's going to pay for these guys, and that's great. And then we're going to build our structure around it, and we're going to change our police force because of it. And then when 3 years goes by, are we going to cut them? Because the police union and the citizens are going to say, no, we want them. Well, where's the money going to come from? And so to me, that those issues are important.
There's real issues. I mean, think about this. Think about with COVID, now that people have worked remotely and they don't have the need for all this office space downtown. And so are they going to go back to their office? They're going to leave their office? So office building is going to be empty, which creates revenue for property tax revenue for the city or the state. People are going to move to the outlying areas. So now you've got less revenue in major cities, and the people that don't have the wherewithal to move to other places, they're still there, but now there's no jobs. I mean, there's some real risk going on right now, and it's will affect not just police, but just general services.
Right.
So,
and even
the
this thing,
the world that we knew, the world that we knew, I mean, everybody was, running along happy, and the stock market was high, and we were at 3.5% unemployment, and there were still job opportunities out there, and everybody going to school. It all came to a screeching halt with COVID. So, how does this get reset, and let alone retrain, decide how you're going to reprogram resources for law enforcement or for civil security?
One more comment I'll make about something you alluded to about when was the last time you rode along with the police. I remember reading an article about Von Miller, who's a pretty active guy in social causes, football player, played for the Denver Broncos.
I met him this year.
And I don't know anything about him other
very,
than
very good guy.
What I read. And then Brandon Marshall, after the Ferguson thing, they said, look, we got to get to a better place. And they said, so we need to get to know the police more. And they did. They rode along with the Denver Police Department. Mm-hmm. And some of the interviews with them afterwards, they said, hey, this is an eye-opener, what these men and women deal with on a nightly basis, the violence, right? I think they both said, I wouldn't do this for a living. So the stuff that goes on in these streets is crazy. And we as a population need to be, when they show up, cooperate with them. Which is a message that, I think we need, especially I've heard Charles Barkley say that. Hey, I've got two messages for people. To police officers, we're all not gangbangers, right? To young black men, my brothers, right? When the cops show up, cooperate, and it tends to work out fine, right? It tends to work out fine. And so I found that very interesting. It's, go see what they deal with and look at the violence on our streets and look at the craziness on our streets. And I think a lot of the judgmental nature of police, I think then you will become more empathetic, as they did, about where the actual problem is here. We're putting people that we don't train, on a sustained basis, right, out into this, if you're in a large city, into this violent environment. They're responding. I think the most deadly calls they go on are domestic violence calls, and they do it every night. And we ask it year after year, and then we don't pull them back and train them very often. And I mean, to me, I wonder if shift supervisors, when something happens, you know, you have this collision of this somebody who's a bit jaded, right? You're not really a human being anymore. You're just another piece of shit that I'm dealing with tonight because I've done it too long. And somebody who's going to be arrested who isn't having it anymore. And the outcome is predictable. When those two forces meet, it ain't going to be good. And how do you prevent it? How do you create the infrastructure? And that's what we've been talking about. So, the empathy thing, I think, for a lot of people that are leaders, get out there and take a look, right? Get out there and take a look. And you're going to find that most of the police officers, the men and women, I mean, they're great people. They serve their community. And that is a tough job. That is a tough job. I want to, is there anything I haven't asked you about what you wrote that, you know, you feel is important?
You know, I've not been a police officer. I've been around police officers. It was just simply a layman's view on what I've seen and what I've observed to try to make it better. You know, this isn't about politics. I mean, you know, turn this into a, you know, this group's better than that, or this person is against that. It's just, hey, look, I think we recognize that the outcomes we're getting too often are not the outcome that we should get or we expect to get, and we don't need to be killing people. There's people dying that I don't believe need to be dead. So I think we need to take a look at this. And there's other issues too, just like the whole racial injustice. And then, you know, there's got to be, you know, what's the core mission of the government other than to defend the nation, provide for the common good? So what is it? Education? Is it infrastructure? Is it roads? Is it support the economy? And we could sit here all day long and argue about whether the money that the United States government has, which is a very substantial amount of money, is it all being spent in the right place in the right amount? And that's why we have elections, and our Congress is supposed to come up with a budget that they're supposed to pass and send to the president. And if he agrees with it or she agrees with it, that gets signed and we execute the plan. But we also got to raise money. And you need an economy, you need taxes, you need terror, you need, you know, duties, you need whatever. And you can't do this for nothing. We've got to have to figure out how to pay for it. So it'll be interesting to see where this all takes us.
Let me switch gears and ask you about Confederate monuments have been in the news, and the naming of United States Army installations over Confederate generals. Your thoughts on that issue?
Well, we've talked about this offline. You know, first, the Confederate flag. I fully agree with what General Berger did, and people say, well, why didn't you do it? It's a fair question. I mean, I remember, I think I've told you this story. So, you know, I've seen Marines, you know, on their truck, usually on their vehicle, you know, have a sticker or something about showing the Confederate stars and bars or something like that. And whenever I saw it and they were there, I would ask them what they thought that meant. And usually the answer is something like, you know, regional pride, or they're like, well, how do you square being a U.S. Marine with sporting the flag on your vehicle of a secessionist state that supported the enslavement of people, fought a civil war against the Union and lost? And what would you say if I told you that many people, that symbol is, you know, is indicative of the oppression of another human being, the enslavement of another human being, the denial of all their rights, and yet you've took an oath to the Constitution of the United States to defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic? And I've talked to lawyers and I listened to them, and they said, well, that's the expression of their rights. It's kind of the same discussion that people had previously about, well, you can't say anything about to people about what they do on social media.
Right.
Well, yeah, you can. you know, you're still a United States Marine. So I didn't do it. I wish I had. I'm not proud of that, and I support General Berger. I think that there's no way you can justify a member of the United States military flying that flag on their personal vehicle or anywhere else. In the country, you know, people have their rights and they can do that. But on the military, you know, we give up certain prerogatives, even though we are American citizens, to do our duty. On the monuments, on the bases, I think there needs to be a discussion about that. You know, General, the dilemma is, hey, our history is our history, particularly the monuments. I mean, we had a civil war. We had hundreds and thousands of soldiers and civilians killed on both sides. It was horrible. We followed by Reconstruction and huge acrimony and the development of, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, and then Reconstruction ended when Grant ended his second term. I think it was Grover Cleveland became the president, and we ended up with Jim Crow. And people, Americans don't know their own history. And so the monument thing, at the same time, though, it's part of our history. How do I teach somebody about that period of time in our nation if I don't say, they go, Grandpa, what's that statue? Well, that's a statue of this guy who was a general for the Confederacy, and he led troops against the Union, and they lost because they supported the enslavement of another human being. You know, down here, you know, the people of, you know, certain, you know, they, there are people that defaced a Civil War monument of a black soldier from the regiment, well, Massachusetts regiment. So they just saw a Civil War soldier, didn't even know what it was. But I think that's a worthy discussion. The base thing, those bases were named in the 20s and 30s. A lot of great soldiers have come and gone since then. And you know, I've heard Secretary Esper and Chief of Staff of the Army and Secretary Gates, former Secretary of Defense Gates. Hey, there's other ways to do this. And I don't think that we're supposed to be, the United States military stands for unity. We're the one organization in this, one of the organizations, if not the organization in this country, that takes people from every walk of life and every corner of the nation. And we bring them together and we form them into a team. Anything that we do that doesn't support that or causes people to think that they're not part of that team is counterproductive. And so we shouldn't do it.
So you would support renaming the bases?
I would. Yeah. I would. And then, the statue thing is, I think, is a little more complex. I mean, there are no perfect people in this world that I'm aware of, other than maybe, you know, if you're a Christian and the person you believe, you know, came to this earth as the Son of God. But even he would admit, I think, that he was not without sin. I'm not trying to get religious. I'm not. That's your personal business. But, you know, so you could find fault. I mean, George Washington, we're going to tear down the Washington Monument because George Washington was a slaveholder when he was president, even though he did free the slaves. Thomas Jefferson.
Rename the city.
Rename the city, change the currency. And I'm being kind of facetious here, but. I mean, our history is our history. So
now the question is, how far does it go? So we start.
How far do we go? I mean, and so there's got to be the bases, the flag. I think that's, I fully support that. Right. I think there needs to be a bigger discussion. But if the state, each state, and the way our federal system is set up, if the local town or the state wants to, you know, move these statues to another area or put them in a museum, that's their prerogative. But what I don't think we can allow to happen is we can't deny our history because it helps us. You can't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been.
You and I are have the same positions. Bleaching our history and destroying it is absolutely wrong. To me, maybe we have to, build out in the Jefferson Memorial, add another mural that talks about Jefferson as a slave owner. He was not a perfect human being, but this is his contribution to our country. And it's a huge contribution to Western civilization, the whole concept that was not, where we went and fought, and that was, minority rights, which is quintessentially, American in terms of its articulation and Jeffersonian in its origination. But he was a flawed man, and maybe that's where our history has to go, saying that, throughout our history, there's been flawed people, and we want to tell you all of the story, not part of the story, and we're not interested in bleaching our history. And I think that's where those statues need to go, in parks that tell this whole story, the good and the bad, and that's how you learn from history. But I'm with you. The base thing to me, we should not ask anybody of color to go to work on a base that honors somebody that fought to overthrow our system of government and to enslave, to embrace a system that enslaved, black human beings as property. Take that history, put it in the base museum, and tell the whole story. I think that's important. All right, anything else before I let you go that you want to get off your chest?
What's wrong with Major League Baseball? Why can't these guys – of course, I heard the NBA. I don't know if the NBA is coming back now. But baseball, it's got to be about the money. I know you have family ties into that business, but, we need – the country needs something to think about or watch other than what we see on the news all the time. And sports gives us that. And it would be great if the owners and the Players Association and the players and the commissioner could get together and figure out some way to play, whatever number of games. And even if there's nobody, I was watching the PGA had their first tournament up in Fort Worth at the Colonial, very, iconic, home of Ben Hogan and all that. And there was nobody there. But watching on TV, it didn't bother me. I just wanted to watch the golf.
Right.
And hopefully the NHL will come back, and whether they're playing in an empty stadium, everybody getting tests, trying to be safe. It sounds kind of petty that, that we need sports, but it's part of our culture. And so it'd be nice if they would get their act together and do it. And I think they can do it in a safe way, but
baseball's an embarrassment because their fight is over money. It's not over doing it safely. It's not over travel and how we're going to do it. It's straight up over money, and it's a prelude to their collective bargaining, deal that they'll do at the end of next season, I believe. And it's because of bad blood that lingers from the last collective bargaining agreement. Mm-hmm. And somehow or the other, they cannot find the adults to get into the room to say, we're turning more people against our game. And, it's billionaires and millionaires arguing about money. And in a day and time in this country where people are looking for relief, and so to me it's embarrassing and it's disgusting, and this is how people turn the TV off and don't come back. Let me ask you one more question, which is a dicey question, I'll ask you, the national anthem thing. It's a lot of people, a lot of veterans look at that and say, it's a moment of unity when, I believe everybody should stand. We've buried a lot of, Marines, sailors, soldiers, and airmen underneath that flag over the course of our nation's wars for the last 19 years. And now I've got to watch somebody protest during that time. And I understand the reason for their protests. I understand the reason for their feelings. But I'm offended. What your thoughts on all of that?
You know, flags are, I mean, we were talking about the Confederate flag. I mean, flags, you know, the flag of a nation, the flag of a unit, the flag of an organization, it's something that, you know, rally around the flag, and there's all sorts of quotes, and the flag is iconic. I was at the YMCA, I was lifting weights today, and they had, you know, Coach Popovich from San Antonio was, you know, attacking the NFL commissioner about, and now he's coming out and supporting Colin Kaepernick and the others for kneeling, and he's, you know, making disparaging remarks about people, only politicians glom onto the flag. Well, I don't think the Marines that were on top of Suribachi were glomming onto the flag for political reasons in 1945. And I don't think the flag, you know, the flag means different things to different people. But do I wish that the players would stand for the playing the national anthem? I do. Do I understand the symbology of their not wanting to do that by kneeling? I do. And as a citizen, I think we're trying to make this into, I mean, we're going to go play football. All right. So, you know, I would have gone to them and said, hey, look, you know, I think we lost perspective on what they were kneeling for. I think now everybody's like, oh, this is what you were talking about. Well, yeah, Kaepernick was talking about this, but we didn't, you know, until the George Floyd thing was like right in our face, everybody went, oh, so that's what you're talking about? Yeah, it's the same thing I've been talking about for the last 5, 10, 15, 20, 40, 100 years. And so I don't, you know, some people want to get real excited about it, and I'm not trying to lowball it, but, you know, they're American citizens. They're playing football. They're playing a game, making a whole lot of money. And if they want to kneel, I think you're going to see if they do play this season, I think you'll see everybody kneel. The coaches will kneel. I don't know what the refs will do. I don't know what the refs are going to do. There won't be anybody in the stadium. But do I wish that they would stand? Do I think that the flag of the United States, as imperfect a nation as we are, is worthy of standard attention? You teach your children, your grandchildren, you know, when you hear the national anthem, you stop, you face the music, you take your, if you have a hat on your head, you put it, take it off, and put your hand over your heart, and you wait for the national anthem. And if you want to sing, you sing the song, the words of the national anthem. And probably won't happen this year. But does that mean they're damned to hell? And you know, so make your point. We'll just go play ball. And then if that draws attention to these issues, which I think are also important, and we can do a better job as a nation, find our better angels and treat each other with more dignity and respect, and police can be better police and citizens can be better citizens, and maybe we'll be in a different place. But I'm trying to take the long view and the high road here and not get down in the middle of whether you do or do not stand for the playing of the national anthem. There's think about the bigger issues, and you know, if I were a coach, I'd say, okay, I understand my players feel the way they do, and I've talked to them and I've asked them, you know, to stand. They chose to kneel. I respect their right to exercise their First Amendment rights of, you know, of expression and speech, because it's symbolic speech. And in order to support them in solidarity, I will kneel, or I won't kneel, or we'll hold hands, or we'll link arms, or we'll do whatever we're going to do so that this issue doesn't get lost again. We can take it, you know, maybe this is an opportunity where we can improve the, you know, our sense of community in this country, and people stop being afraid of each other for reasons that are not valid for them being afraid of each other. So that, that's kind of where I am. There's other things that I'm more concerned about in this country that have greater significance to me, whether or not somebody kneels for the national anthem or not at a football game.
A final question. I had a retired Marine gunnery sergeant who happens to be black on the program yesterday. And he said, you know, I asked him, you know, what do you think's, you know, what haven't I asked you that you want to say? And he said, we cannot be afraid to talk about this. Yeah. And we are. You get everybody in the room and you say, all right, who's got something to say? And we both have sat in those meetings. I remember you leading one about don't ask, don't tell. And you divided the room in half. And you made half of us, we had a debate, you know, for, you know, gays, you know, in the military and gays not in the military. And, but I remember sitting in that room out in 29 Palms and nobody wanted to say anything. Right. And so, are we capable of having that discussion?
No. I think you defeat an insurgency by bringing one person over at a time.
Right.
This is deep. So it's not going to be, I think it's really going to be, you know, I saw something about, you know, who should be in charge of diversity of corporations. And quite frankly, if you know, in the past, you know, you have a minority, a man of color and ethnicity, or a woman, you know, telling other groups, you know, that this is the law and this is what they have to do, as opposed to explaining, hey, this is why this is a diversity may be advantageous to you. For a lot of reasons, to include your profit or your bottom line, just like, you know, there's more and more research showing that if your business is environmentally sensitive and you're aware of global warming and you're doing stuff that's in line with, you know, being smart about the environment, you're going to make more money. So it's tough, and I that, you know, back in the 70s after Vietnam, I mean, our racial situation in the Marine Corps, right? And they had all the services. I mean, you go back and look at the riots on the Ranger, the USS Ranger, and I mean, people were killing each other, literally. Murder in the barracks, and it was terrible. And General Wilson said, okay, we need to talk about it. So he, at the basic school, every second lieutenant went through a program of instruction which certified you as a human relations discussion group leader, or HUMREL. It's stamped in your OQR on a page 11. And then you had to teach 20 hours of HUMREL to your unit. So I'm not sure how effective I was in an unair-conditioned conference room at Camp Hansen in July with 150 Marines in there that was broken down probably 50-50 white and the rest black and Latino, trying to tell them they should love each other as God's children and judge each other by the quality of their character, not the color of their skin. But that's what I did. I tried to do. I tried to make the case. I mean, because they tried to force the discussion. And over a period of time, you know, the Marine Corps, I think, did better as far as being, you know, the idea of every Marine is green. Every Marine is not green. Every Marine is a Marine. But you've got all model type series, and all now even more so. You've got men and women. You've got, you know, black, white, Latino, Asian, and then whatever else in the middle. And then you've got gay people. You've got straight people. You've got there are transgender people out there, as I know. I've met them. I've talked to them, and they're serving. and they want to do their job. And then if you told me I would hold the same views that I hold today 40 years ago or 45 years ago, I would have said, no, I will never agree to this or that. But I've changed because I've seen it and I've talked to these folks. And they're human beings with the same goals and aspirations and motivations that we all have. You know, I want to do better. I want to improve myself. I want to get educated. I want to raise a family. I want to have my children have a better life than me. I want to own a house. You know, I don't want to be rich, but I just, you know, I don't want to have to worry about where my next meal is coming from. And I want to be treated with respect. And I will treat everybody else the same. So how do we get there? We engage. And if somebody doesn't portray that type of behavior, you tell them to stop. And if they don't, you tell them to leave. And,
you know, I just thought the first protest of the national anthem that I can recall is at the Summer Olympics in 1968, when Tommy Smith and
Lee Evans and Tommy Smith.
Lee Evans.
You know, they rose the black fist because right. They were second and third or first and third in the 200 meters.
Right, right.
And Mexico, yeah.
And, you know, 52 years later, we're still struggling, right, to get this right. And the national anthem is still being used in that capacity by people who view it. I mean, I think, and I've been sitting here thinking while you've been talking, because my view is I don't want to watch somebody, you know, as I view the national anthem, I'm looking across somebody's casket. I'm looking over a flag that I'm presenting to the same woman two different times for two different sons. And you're going to tell me that you don't mean to be disrespectful to that flag?
Yeah. I hear you.
When you look across a casket and you look at a mother's eyes for the second time and your brain's telling you, you just look over her head so she thinks she's looking at you, right? But you've got to say these words because they're really important that you say them. But from the inner city, that view, as you know, I'm sitting here thinking, is equally as compelling. Looking over the casket of Eric Gardner and Mr. Floyd and now Mr. Brooks is equally as compelling, and maybe the longer view and the more restrained view is a view that we need to stop having these protests need to happen in order to affect change. But it's hard because I think you look on both those sides, those are deep emotional feelings, you know, that are spurred by, you know, memories. You know, Drew Brees' comments, both based on his grandfather's fighting in World War II, you know, that's real. I mean, those memories are real. Those memories of them telling him stories, him going to cemeteries with them, that's all real. And so I think your admonition, the longer view, a little bit more restrained, although it's difficult. I mean,
the flag is an emotional thing. This whole thing is emotional.
Right.
Because everybody's had something and they have a story or an anecdote or which may or may not be true. But, you know, the flag is a powerful, maybe the most powerful, not just the United States, but any country. But we have, you know, maybe people have hijacked it for political reasons, which I think Popovich was saying. But I mean, the flag is important, but at the same time, so is being a citizen and your ability to express your dissent in a way it's not illegal. They didn't burn the flag. They didn't spit on the flag. They didn't tear the flag up. They didn't stomp on the flag. And so what I would do, if I were the commissioner of the National Football League, and I would hire a bunch of people, you know, that had deep convictions about in their service in the military and tell them, and I'd have them go talk to the players. Say, look, you can do whatever you want, but let me understand you. Here's why I would like you to stand, or at least you can kneel at the beginning, but get up before the end of the national anthem or something, some middle ground. So you make your point, we can all make our point and then get up. Or, you know, it's not like they're turning their back and they're sitting down. I think kneeling is, you know, I heard, you know, it actually was a white special operations guy that was, had been a long snapper with playing with Kaepernick that gave him the idea to kneel. Because kneeling is, you know, kneeling is a position of reverence. You kneel in church. You know, you kneel when you get before you take communion. You kneel, you know, kneeling before the altar. So it's not like you're sitting. It's not like you're turning your back. And I'm not trying to rationalize it, I think Kaepernick was very, you know, he thought this through. And, but again, okay. And now, you know, he was upset for whatever reason. I mean, we know why he's upset, because he's tired of having to go through the indignities. So he's a guy, African American, adopted by white parents, right, as I understand the story. And so he's seen both worlds. It's complicated. Everything's complicated.
Hard. It's hard.
We're easy, but
again, you know what I'm thinking.
I think we need to pay attention and not get caught up in the emotion and the screaming and yelling of everybody over the issue, and think about why it's happening, and then exercise what your conscience tells you to do. What's right?
No, I think that. What you said is important, and that is, I don't care what side you're on. Listen to somebody else who's been as affected as you have been on one side from the other side, and then figure it out. And maybe if restraint on all sides is the way that we get this problem that we have in this country, to a better place, then maybe that's the best course of action. So I know, yeah, I've taken up a bunch of time tonight, and I appreciate you doing this. Certainly have made me think tonight, relative to my own perspective and my perspective, you know, just here in the last 10 minutes of, you know, as you have done, presenting flags, standing there at flags, looking at the carnage, looking at shattered families, and that flag is, you know, has been a huge part of our lives. But again, go back to empathy. You know, do you have the empathy to step out of yourself to look through somebody else's, you know, vision port, knowing that it's tinted differently, it's cut differently, see what's real to them, and find some middle ground? And I think that's probably great advice. So I appreciate you doing this again.
All right, Mac. You be safe, and thanks, everybody. You know, be the best of whoever you are that you can be to both your family and everybody else. And please be safe. You may be tired of COVID, but COVID's not tired of you. And we need to be healthy so we can get through this.
All right. Take care. Let me know when you're going to write something again, and so we can do this.
Yeah,
again.
I've got a couple things I'm working on, but I got to write my book first. Darcy's nagging me. I got to write the book.
What's the book?
Oh, I got to do a leadership book, and I'm going to write about 2006 in Anbar.
Oh.
We can tell the story about the night the guy went UA from his post north of Fallujah and ran out in the middle of the Jazeera until the F-8.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I was micromanaging.
Oh, my God. Literally over my shoulder, telling them he's just to the right. Wait, with the MEF sergeant major up forward and to the right of us, looking at the monitor, yelling back. And I finally turned around and said, "This has to stop."
Yeah.
And I will tell you the one thing I've always been, he looked at me and he said, "This is awful, isn't it?" I said, "You don't even know." I said, will you take him and get the fuck out of here, please? And he said,
yeah.
And he said, all right, we're leaving. Sergeant Major, come on. And they left. And then they found this kid, ultimately, you know, in the race.
Oh, I remember. Right? I remember watching when they found him.
And we, I said.
That's when I left.
Yeah, I said, shut that.
I didn't want to know. Shut off the video.
Shut the video off. Because, no, it was literally a race between us and them. Are they going to find him? And are we going to see him on TV getting his head sawed off? Or are we going to find him? You know, and then the guys out there risking their lives at night with IEDs in the ground and all that. And you're thinking, are we going to have guys get killed? So the many memories of at that time, Brigadier General.
It's funny now. It wasn't funny.
It wasn't funny that night of, Brigadier at the time, Brigadier General, Deputy MEF Commander, Brigadier General Bob Neller. So anyway,
All right. Talk to you later.
Thank you. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.